Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the fourth part of our Sustainable Future Series 2020. My name is Michaela Simon-Howard, and I'm a Sustainable and Impact Investing Strategist in the Chief Investment Office of UBS Global Wealth Management. Since early summer, we have been presenting to you various topics at the core of sustainable investing and with the insights of global experts. Today, I'm honored to have two inspiring speakers with me to discuss the future of food. Food is life, and producing it has reshaped our planet. Today, whole economies and even national security depend on it. However, the current agriculture system is unsustainable. Agriculture already accounts for most of our water and a high percentage of our land use, as well as the bulk of human-generated greenhouse gases. Resources are shrinking, and it becomes more challenging to find solutions how to feed a growing, urbanizing population without further damaging the earth. By 2050, global meat demand will be 70% higher than today's level. Our planet simply doesn't have enough land and water to produce this much meat using animals, and trying to do so would devastate the environment. A lasting solution will require a substantial rethink about how we as a society live and grow our food. The good news is that an agricultural revolution is at hand. Great innovations, including trends in vertical farming, aquaculture, biotech, blockchain, and robotics are transforming the way we produce food and will continue to do so for some time. The ability to create food that replicates meat, fish, eggs, and dairy products with a lower carbon footprint and without the need to slaughter animals is likely to become a commercially viable option in this decade. For example, growing meat in a lab could cut greenhouse gas emissions caused by agriculture by 78 to 96% while using 99% less land. Professor Mark Post, Chief Scientific Officer at Mosameat, will provide us with some great insights into this topic. Known as the father of cultured meat, Mark is the scientist behind the world's first slaughter-free hamburger. His background is in medicine, where as a doctor and researcher, he worked on tissue engineering for vascular grafts. My colleague and chief economist at UBS Global Wealth Management, Paul Donovan, has for a long time focused on the topic of environmental economics. In two of his books, he looked at our ability to manage the environmental credit crunch that looms. So, let's take a deep dive into the topic of food with our experts at hand. Mark, in 2013, you presented the world's first burger made from growing cow cells in a laboratory. The burger cost back then 250,000 euros to produce and was funded by Google co-founder Sergey Brin. How much do your burgers cost now, and who are your funders today?
Thanks for the question. The burgers now are still expensive. We're still scaling up production, and after scaling, we envision it to be around 10, 15 euros per burger. So that's still expensive, still not kind of supermarket material, more for restaurants, but already way down from 250,000. And we know how to get them even lower than that, but that will take a little bit more time. Funders are a mix of mission-driven investors, mostly focusing on animal welfare and environment, so the big impact of livestock agriculture on our systems. Strategic investors such as the Bell Food Group from Switzerland, a meat producer, meat processor, I would say, and then we also have biotech investors such as Merck Ventures, and currently also people from or companies from the feed industry, which is strategically important for sourcing eventually cheap and scalable nutrients for the cell culture.
Oh, very interesting. I mean, this shows really that there is a not single line interest, but this has really a major impact going forward. So as you just mentioned, so I guess the chance that I will find a lab-grown burger in my local supermarket sometime soon is rather small. But when do you think you will be able to access the market, actually, and who are the clients you are going to target then?
The access to the market will mainly be determined by the speed of regulatory approval. So in Europe, this is a novel food, meaning that EFSA, the European Food Safety Authority, has to qualify this as being safe for consumers. So we have to provide all the evidence, file an application, and then they have a year and a half to decide whether this is sufficient evidence to prove safety for consumption, and then it's allowed to the market. So that's the very least it's going to take. We have not filed yet. So far as I know, nobody has filed yet. In other countries or other geographies, it might go a little bit faster, but here in Europe, it's definitely going to take at least a year and a half. So the first 2 years, 2.5 years, nothing on the market, I would think. After that, it will be relatively small scale, and given that it will still be a premium price, most likely in restaurants, very similar to how the Impossible Burger has been introduced in the States and then kind of gradually conquers the market.
Very well. Paul, just turning to you, in 2011 and 2014, you published two fascinating books looking at the impact the financial credit crunch had on our environment and discussing how we treat food. You argued then that a significant and positive difference could be made by changing some of the ways in which we procure, prepare, and consume our food. Do you feel that any fundamental changes have been achieved over the past years?
I think there have been some shifts. I think that there is increased awareness about the environmental costs associated with food. And that has been coming through more and more clearly in terms of consumer spending patterns, what consumers are expecting. I think there has been a lot more focus on packaging and the potential adverse impacts of packaging, which again has been a consumer-led shift, particularly around the use of plastics with regards to food packaging and the environmental waste that is associated with that. We've also, I think, seen a trend towards, if not outright vegetarianism, certainly a reduced role for meat in several developed economy diets, more with the younger generation perhaps, but there has again been a shift, and that's partly health related, but I think it is also environmentally related. So that's, I think, the good news. The negative news, I think, is that we still have a very fragmented approach towards food. So, you know, in the cry of we must reduce plastic packaging, which is obviously a valid environmental point, we may also be increasing food waste by simply reducing the shelf life of food and things like that. So we're still in a relatively disjointed approach towards food policy, but there have certainly been some shifts over the last few years.
Well, I rather like the good news you just described, coming to the what you just said, fragmented ways to deal with this, but it was also obviously fragmented or further disturbed by the current pandemic. So another crisis which influenced our behaviors and probably partly reversed some of the good things you just mentioned were tackled before. So food was and is once more in focus for various reasons. For example, we partly had supply chain issues and we started cooking and baking more at home, which is a positive part. But what does this all mean from an economic point of view?
Well, I think it underscores that food is disproportionately important economically. People are very, very sensitive to food prices, and we have seen food price increases during the pandemic, which consumers are very much aware of. We know that this is always the case because food is a high frequency purchase. We've also seen, I think, some interesting shifts in consumption patterns. Obviously, there's been a decline in restaurant spending and so forth, inevitably, just because of the nature of the pandemic. But also, I think, because we have accelerated structural change in the economy. You know, what economists call the fourth industrial revolution is happening somewhat faster. So things like home working are coming in. But home working, again, significantly changes consumption patterns. Ultimately, in a way that is probably more economically and environmentally efficient, in terms of food waste, in terms of transport costs and other issues, you know, making a sandwich at home is more efficient than buying a sandwich from a local store near your office. So we are seeing some shifts in consumption patterns come through there, which will, I think, be quite enduring. I think that some of these structural changes in the economy are going to be quite long lasting. So we are starting to see shifts in consumer behavior being dictated not just by the pandemic directly, but by the social changes that the pandemic is accelerating. And all of that feeds back into economic and environmental efficiency around food.
That's very interesting. So, Mark, I guess COVID also brought some changes for your company. I'm thinking of two particular aspects. So working from home might be a challenge for your business. However, what Paul just mentioned, the social changes, with people having had time to reflect on various aspects of their life during the lockdown and partly becoming more health and environmental conscious, did you receive more interest in your product?
Yeah, of course, COVID had an impact. We are mostly doing research and development, so it's a lot of work in the lab. The labs are typically small and a lot of people work there, so you have to restrict the number of people in the lab and therefore you can be less effective. Fortunately, we have an extremely highly motivated crowd of people, so they kind of distribute their working hours over the 24 hours of a day so that we could at least have a decent level of activity, but still only 30-40% of our regular activity. So it has slowed us down a bit, at least by a couple of months, which is not dramatic, but it's there, noticeable. In terms of how people are looking at, for instance, products like meat, we have seen in during COVID a couple of the real kind of intense contamination areas in slaughterhouses in the meat industry, not really related with the meat itself, but more with how labor practices are being employed in that industry, which is in part, again, a reflection of that consumers really want their meat as cheap as possible. So there are all sorts of perverse stimuli in the industry to make this as cheap as possible. And that translates into working conditions for people, and that makes them more vulnerable for COVID contamination. That has nothing to do with the product itself. I think there was some kind of inferences in the newspapers that related COVID as a, or that talked about COVID as a disease coming from animals. And of course, it comes from animals. And we have seen a fair number of these diseases coming from intense farming, African swine fever, for instance, that wiped out most of the Chinese pork industry a couple of years ago. Those are really a result of a very intense farming. This particular virus did seem to come from wildlife and not so much from intense farming. So, yes, there are always mechanisms that to tell people, oh yeah, this is again part of our meat consumption behavior. I think for COVID that was less true, but it still has it's still true that a lot of diseases coming from industrial farming has affected our lives. And that's one of the aspects that we want to get rid of.
Very good. So, but your business is still more or less in a startup stage, as we just heard early on. What have been actually the challenges in the early days of your business, so when you really started up, compared to the challenges you are facing today at a slightly different stage of the business growth?
Well, in the beginning, we were the only ones in the world doing this, so there was a lot of skepticism and not a lot of funding in neither by governments nor by the industry. We were kind of lucky to run into Sergey Brin, as mentioned, who really liked this idea and was willing to fund a, at that time, crazily expensive hamburger. In the meantime, a lot of things have changed. We are now looking at 50, 60 companies worldwide doing the same thing. Actually, have adopted the same technology for fish, for pork, for chicken, for beef. So that landscape has changed quite a bit, and also the funding in it has increased tremendously. Still mostly private funding, but has increased tremendously up to the stage that now at least four out of those 60 companies are starting to scale up production and have the intention of bringing this to the market in the next couple of years. So it has, in that respect, it changed a lot. A lot more people are working on these technologies now than they were in 2013.
The competition is tense. Paul, as we heard earlier from Mark, costs are still an issue for lab-grown meat, and you were talking about the environmental costs, and also Mark was just arguing that meat in general is too cheap in a different context, but however we could argue this for several meat products. So not only meats or other food products these days, and they are far too cheap and do not price in externalities. Why do governments not change this?
Well, it comes back to this concept we call frequency bias. Because food is something people buy frequently, they remember the price. And the price assumes disproportionate importance in the minds of the consumer. And so if you get an increase in the price of food, people think inflation is out of control, they think their income is being badly damaged by this, they may change their economic behavior, they may cut back on other spending, say, no, the food bill has gone up and we spend at least half our income on food. Well, actually, in a developed economy, you probably spend about 10% of your income on food, but because you spend money on food very often on a daily basis, you're constantly reminded of the price of it, and it makes it an enormously politically sensitive issue in developed economies. And of course, in emerging markets, it's also very, very important politically, because it's a key barometer of a standard of living. You know, being able to eat meat every day is very often seen as a signal of being middle class in some cultures, and so on and so forth. So the political importance of food and food pricing is very, very high. And governments, I think, are very reluctant to take measures which will lead to any kind of perception of an erosion of standard of living. And we've seen this even in the United States. Things like the tax on sugary drinks in New York leads to an enormous political outcry because people perceive that their standard of living is being hurt far more than is actually the reality.
Very true. Mark, let me come back to something you mentioned earlier on, because we were talking about access to different countries. So are there any differences how your product is perceived in various countries? Is the demand for your product more dependent on consumer behavior or support by governments?
I think my personal experience is that it is differently perceived based on all sorts of cultural aspects. In the Netherlands, for instance, and in most northern European countries, food is not as big a deal, and quality of food is not as big a deal as, for instance, in southern European countries. So there is a lot of difference there, and people in southern European countries look at this much more skeptically. And can you guarantee the same quality and the same experience? Where in the northern countries, people see all the problems associated with meat, say, well, let's start changing this, and the quality of the product is of a lesser concern. We'll look at that later. You also see differences in Asia, for instance, and this is more, I would say, more at the government level. So here in Europe, you see more interest from consumers and more debate among consumers and different layers of consumers, different ages, vegetarians, vegans, and so forth, with different habits. In Asia, for instance, in South Korea and also in Japan, you see more a government-driven push towards these technologies, and the initiative lies much more with the governments than with the population.
That's very interesting. So thinking about that, Paul, how could and should governments look at their food policies then going forward? What needs to change most urgently to bring the environmental credit crunch to a halt?
Well, in a perfect world where economists run everything, I think what we would really be pushing for is more joined up government thinking, more coherent policy across the entire food chain. So from start to finish of the food chain, we need to see a properly integrated approach. And we have to accept that, you know, if humans are going to eat, there will be environmental damage from that. I mean, that is inevitable, because by, you know, feeding a population of 7 billion plus globally, you are going to have an impact on the environment. The question is, how do you minimize that impact and try and make sure that that impact is not permanent? So what I think we need to recognize is that, you know, there may have to be an environmental cost at one link in the food chain if that environmental cost brings a more substantial environmental benefit somewhere else in the food chain. But I think that the problem that we have today, particularly with things like social media campaigns, is that we go very much into single issue politics. So there's a focus on plastic drinking straws, which is great, and I have no problem with that. But that is the focus, and that is the obsession, and people are not perhaps thinking about aspects of water use or transportation or the benefits and costs of local production, because, no, we've got to focus on the drinking straws. And that, I think, is really the risk. We need a very broad approach, which is not going to be necessarily distracted by single-issue politics, and which can make sure that the food chain as a whole is as environmentally robust as it can possibly be.
Thank you very much, Mark and Paul, for your time and fascinating insights today. Future food means that we need to completely transform our global food production system to meet consumers' evolving need for a healthy, nutritious food for all, while conserving our planet's precious resources for future generations. The good news is, as we just heard, that we are on the cusp of a new agricultural revolution that will likely reshape the way we farm, shop, and consume food. Change is driven by 5 megatrends. Firstly, the political economy under scarcity. Second, the new age consumer. Thirdly, simply health and wellness. 4, digital catch-up, and 5, sustainable living. For investors, this is just the beginning, but we are excited about the changes and disruption ahead. The envisaged rapid expansion in areas like alternative meat, farming 4.0, online food delivery, and seed treatment and science. Investing in the future of food helps contributing to positive change while seeking long-term returns. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your interest. We would like to invite you to listen also to our other topics of the Sustainable Future series, which are available as podcasts to listen to at your convenience. Thank you for your interest. Stay healthy and well.